Thank you. I'm an addict called Vito. Hi, family. First of all, I'd like to thank the convention committee for asking me to come and share, because it's really a privilege to be here. It's an honor that I can't put into words. I'd also like to thank my higher power, because without my relationship with my higher power, none of this would be possible. And I'd like to thank the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, because without meetings and fellowship like this, I would probably be dead today. The convention committee asked me to change my format a little bit from what I normally do. They want me to not only speak about the steps, they wanted me to speak about the traditions and how the spiritual principles of the traditions are incorporated into our life. So what I'm going to try to do to get everything in, and I haven't spoken on the traditions probably since the 1980s, I'm going to cut my story a little bit short, because I don't need to talk too much about using. I think everybody in this room is a professional at using. We all know how to do that, and we all know what the pain and the degradation of hitting a bottom is, so I'm not going to go into that, except make it very brief. I started using in the mid-1940s, and I got clean on February 14th, 1960. And when I got clean, treatment centers was not a thing. There was not even detoxes then. The only thing for treatment that they had was called alcoholic wards, what were in the hospitals, and what they were drying out places. Right after the time that I got clean, the first rehabs opened up in the United States, the Phoenix House and the Daytops, which was modeled after both the Minnesota model and the Synanon model. And treatment was something that was new, and recovery for addicts was something that was unheard of. I wound up in the gutter dying in East Orange, New Jersey in 1960 and on February 14th. And I went through the process of going to a hospital because I was infected with both infectious and serum hepatitis from dirty needles and dirty living. And when I was out of the contagious stage, they threw me into an alcoholic ward. And when I got out of there, I had no place to go except a meeting list from some people that came in from the other fellowship, the AA fellowship, and I started, when I got out of there, to attend their meetings. The only thing that happened the first night I walked into an AA meeting, they told me I didn't belong there. People like me don't get better. I had a disease that was immoral and social, and I was not welcome there, because that was for people only that had a problem with alcohol. But they took that meeting list and they circled open meetings, and they said, you could come there if you want to, but people like you don't get better. So tell an addict not to come back, and you know what happens. And I used to walk into these great big speaker open meetings, and I'd sit down, and everybody would move away from me. But what was happening in the 1960s, more and more people like myself begin to walk into those rooms. And we sort of gravitated. One thing about an addict knows another addict. I mean, I walk out here on the street, and I immediately know that that's a place where people are copping. You know, the atmosphere and everything's there. So we could identify each other. So we sort of, when we went into these AA meetings, we stuck together. And we really shared deep. Like, we stand outside of a church where the meeting was, and we say, hey, what's happening, man? And that's about all we spoke to each other. We had no idea how to share feelings, but we knew we belonged together, and we always sat together because nobody would come near us. And I was attending a meeting of the other fellowship in 1964 in the Valesburg section of Newark, New Jersey, when somebody came up and tapped me on the shoulder by a nickname that I got in that fellowship. They said, hey, animal, there's a drug meeting in the back room. So myself and the herd of animals, we went back to the back room. And for those of you old enough here to remember the 1960s, there was two types of people that existed. There was the hippies of that generation, and there was the street people. And most of us that were sitting in that meeting were street people, and we walked into that room, and there was a bunch of hippies. The girls all had long dresses on and flowers in their hair, and the guys with these painted, hand-painted T-shirts with peace signs on them. And they were the love children of that generation. And this particular group of hippies was going across the United States, and every time they'd come into a town, they'd flop into what was called a commune. And the communes in the United States in the 1960s were just safe houses for hippies where they'd go and they'd use. But this bunch of people got clean in California, and they would go in and they'd plop in a commune, and then they'd go to the AA Fellowship and ask to rent a room in the back room. And we got back there, and they introduced themselves and said they were carrying a message called Narcotics Anonymous. And they started to share, and there wasn't much literature then. We had an off-colored white book, and they opened up the meeting, and they started sharing. And I call that the first day of my life, because after sitting in rooms for 4 years in recovery and not being allowed to open my mouth because I could not go into any discussion meetings, I heard these people share. And out of their mouths were coming the crazy thinking that was between my ears. And up to that day, I thought I was unique, I was different, and nobody in the world had the same thinking that I did. And if you found out the way I thought, you'd lock me up in an insane asylum. And they asked us locals if we wanted to share, and that was the first time that I was able to share after 4 years in recovery. And when these hippies went off, we tried to keep meetings going ourselves. There was two problems. Even though some of us had clean time, we had no recovery. And there is a difference between being clean and having recovery. The only thing that we had known about recovery is a lot of addicts then were coming out of these newfound rehabs. And they were, at that time, there was what they called confrontation therapy. Somebody would share what's going on with them, and everybody would gang up on them. And so what was happening is we'd put somebody in the hot seat, and then the chairs start flying, the tables start flying, and the NA meetings turned out to be riots because we had no idea what recovery was all about. Plus, in the part of the United States that I was living was laws called Rockefeller laws. If two or more addicts congregated together, you'd go to jail. We weren't allowed to meet, and we had to meet in secret. But I kept in contact with one of these addicts who later went back to California. He was living in San Diego. And he asked me to come out there, and I figured when I got to California in the latter part of 1964, I'd find a lot of this Narcotics Anonymous. And when I got to San Diego, there was only two NA meetings in the whole town. One was up on Mission Hill at a Catholic church, and the only reason the addicts were able to meet in that church, they lied to the priest. They said they were AA because nobody would rent to addicts. So we even get pretty slick in recovery. And the other meeting was in East San Diego in the Black Panther Clubhouse, and they had no problem running to us. They knew what we were all about. But, see, the rest of the week we had to go to other places for our recovery, but those of us who went to NA, we stuck together like glue. And we started talking and writing about the steps, the Narcotics Anonymous way. And I was going on 5 years clean, and I had not had a sponsor for 5 years. Because I felt that there was nobody could sponsor me because I was not as sick as you folks. And what had happened is people were coming in after me and they were getting better and I was still sick. I used to wait for people to relapse so I could roll them. I mean that, but I was clean. You know, that's where the expression is, physically clean but spiritually dirty, and I was very spiritually dirty. And I asked this man to sponsor me. And he says, sure, I'll sponsor you, Vito. Where are you with the steps? I looked at him like, you know, puzzled. What do you mean, where am I with the steps? I've heard them read every night for 5 years. And, you know, we see people like that today because I thought working the steps is just going to the meeting and reading them. And he said, where are you with the first step? And I said, well, what kind of a question is that? I'm powerless over drugs and my life had become unmanageable. And he said to me, where is the word drugs in the first step? So I picked up the step and said, we admitted we were powerless over addiction. I pointed to the word addiction. I said, what's the difference between drugs and addiction? And he said, I'll tell you what the difference is. Drugs is what you put in your body. Addiction is that funny looking thing between your ears. He went on to tell me when an addict is in his own head, he's in a bad neighborhood, behind enemy lines, and that the disease of addiction was a disease of personality, a disease of negative thinking, a disease of running away from reality, living a fantasy life, and the getting and using was the end result, and that my disease was alive and well, and I had to feed my disease by medicating myself. And at that time, when I used to go to meetings, I used to identify, my name is Vito, and I'm a cross-addicted drug addict, alcoholic, junkie, heroin addict, and any other names I could stick in. And he would say to me, you've never worked the first step, Vito, because until you identify as an addict only, not drug addict, you're putting the emphasis on the drugs and not on the disease. And he said, from that time on, I want you to identify as an addict only. Because, see, the drugs have never been your problem. They were the result of your problem. And what he did is he closed the back door on me, and I realized what the disease concept of addiction is. It goes deeper than the drugs. I'm an addict long before I put chemicals in my body. And he explained to me that the first step was the things of my past that I brought into recovery, and the next 11 steps could become my future if I chose to use them. And then he explained to me, and I touched on this a little bit last night, that taking a first step is like stripping naked and going out in the middle of the street. If you stand out there naked too long, something's going to happen to you. And the second step is putting new clothes on. And in my infinite wisdom, I informed my sponsor is that we were skipping 2 and 3 and going to 4. Because I'm different. And he said to me, well, what's different about you? I said, but you don't understand. I'm an agnostic. And I don't get into this God stuff. And he asked me a question there that nobody had asked me up to that time. And I had to think hard to answer him. He said, Vito, why are you an agnostic and not an atheist? And he stumped me. And I just turned around and I said, well, just in case there's a God, I want him to know I wasn't an atheist. And he said, typical addict, you always have to have a bad back door. Then he looked at me and he says, there's no such thing as an agnostic. And I said, what do you mean there's no such thing? He said, agnostic is nothing more than a chicken atheist. Can you imagine your sponsor calling you chicken? And he said, anyway, dummy, you don't meet God till the third step. And I said, well, don't dope fiend me. I hear people go to meetings and start talking about a power greater than themselves and a higher power all in the same breath. And he said, they're wrong. He said, a power greater than yourself is anything that makes you aware of the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting different results. And he said, in your addiction, you had a power greater than yourself. You had drugs. Drugs was a power greater than yourself on a daily basis. And he said, yes, someday in this program, you have the right to have a God of your own understanding, but that God is not going to open the sky and send down angels and fix things for you. That God's going to work through people, places, and things. So you'll always find the power greater than yourself through people, places, and things. And that made sense to me. And then he looked at me and he said, for you, a power greater than yourself is pain, because that's the only damn thing that gets your attention. And that's true for a lot of us addicts. If it hurts enough, we're willing to do it different. But until the pain gets that great, we're not willing to make changes. Thank God today I don't have to get to that place all the time to make changes. But there are days that it's got to hurt before I'm willing to change something. Then it was time to go on to that third step, and I informed my sponsor and my infinite wisdom that we're skipping that one because that got the G-O-D word in it. And he said to me, I want you to read the step. And, you know, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. He said, please repeat the last part of that. I says, as God as we understand him. He said, in the program of Narcotics Anonymous, you can have a higher power any type you want. If you can relate to a rock in the backyard and that rock can be loving and caring, that could be the God of your own understanding. He said, but I don't even think you're that nutso. Why don't you just take G-O-D and change it to good orderly direction and let good orderly direction be the God of your understanding just for today? And that was my first higher power. Of course, it's changed many times through the years, and I don't need to get into what it is today, except that this program allows us all to have a God of our own understanding or a God of our not understanding, as long as it's loving and caring. And so there's no requirement on it. However, in the third step, he introduced me into something I hated then, I hate today, my sponsees hate. He said we can start journaling or writing. And he told me I needed to go out and buy a dictionary. And I looked at him and said, why do I need to buy a dictionary? I was born in the United States. I could speak English. I don't need a dictionary. He said, we'll see. So I went out, and this was in 1965 or 64. I bought one of these little pocket dictionaries that cost me like 75 cents. It's probably about $5 today. And I came back and I showed him my dictionary, and he said, "That's not going to do. I want you to go out and buy a college dictionary. You know, one of those big, thick ones." I said, "Well, that costs money. I don't want to spend money on that." He says, "Get it." Well, at this time, the obsession to use was being taken from me, because the first 5 years in this program, I had the obsession to use on a daily basis because I wasn't working steps and I had no sponsor and I didn't want to go back there. So I took direction and I went out and I bought this dictionary. And he said, "What I want you to do is to look up the word decision, look up the word lives, and look up the word will. And I want you to write about them." And I looked up the word decision, and when I opened this dictionary, I immediately knew an addict had to write it, because it had one word and it had 5-6 different definitions on every word. I mean, who else but an addict can make a word? I didn't know words meant so many different things. So I looked up the word decision, and one of the definitions in the dictionary said a place to begin, a starting point. And that seemed to make sense with the word decision. Then I looked up the word lives, and it didn't exist in the dictionary. So immediately I had to call my sponsor up and confront him, and "You made me spend this money on a dictionary that doesn't have the word lives in it." He said, "Dummy, look up the word life and you'll find it under a subheading." I was the one that was so smart. And I looked up the word life, and that had about 7 or 8 definitions. One of them, to be alive. I mean, I could have figured that one out. The state of breathing. But one of them said, things that occur in a lifetime. And that seemed to make sense what the step was talking about. Then when I looked up the word will, I got an education, because one of the definitions of the word will was your reaction to things that happen. So I called my sponsor up. I had this great big spiritual awakening. I said, "I got it figured out now. I know why people go to meetings and say, turn it over. I go out and create my bullshit. I turn it over to God. He fixes it and it cleans the slate and I can start all over again." And he said, "Wrong." He said, "There's nowhere in the third step that says to turn it over." And I says, "What do you mean? I hear people come to meetings saying, turn it over." He said, "Read the step." He said, "When you read the step, you'll find out it says, turn it over to the care of." And I said, "Well, what the hell's the difference between turning it over and turning it over to the care of? You know, as far as I was concerned, it was all the same thing." He said, "Well," and he had to talk to me like I was a little boy, because I was kind of brain dead. And he said, "If you ever grow up someday and somebody is dumb enough to marry you and you had a couple kids and you wanted to go out on a Saturday night, you would turn the kids over to a care of a babysitter to watch and guide in your absence. You wouldn't turn your kids over to the babysitter." Well, you're not to take your will in your life and turn it over to God. You're to turn it over to the care of God. God will not make you a robot or a zombie, because you have free will, and that's a gift that can never be taken from you. So what you do is you take your life and your will and turn it over to the care of God and ask Him to guide it in your life. And then he looked at me and he said, "Get a job." Now, I'm 5 years clean and I haven't gone to work yet. See, I learned that when I was living in California, there was this thing called welfare. And if you were a drug addict, you were classified as sick, so you could sign up for this, and the state would send you 2 checks a month. And then you take this checks and you go to the local pool hall and you play a game that's called nine ball, which is a money game, and you turn that welfare check into a bunch of money. And so I said to my boss, "I got a job. I shoot pool for a living." He said, "Get a job." So this agnostic says to his sponsor, in all his infinite wisdom, "When God gives me a sign, I'll get a job." God became convenient on my terms. And he just looked at me and he said, "I'm going to tell you what God's will is today, tomorrow, and 100 years from now. To act as mature and responsible as you possibly can from where you are in your recovery, and the results will be as mature and responsible as they possibly can." And I said, "Huh?" He said, "Get a job." And I went out and I got a job, and I found out that addicts, the skills that we have for survival in the streets work wonderful in the business world. We are survivors. And I found out I could... I could make a very good living in the world, and I found out I could, and I started to accumulate a lot of material things, and material in my life was going very well, but my program wasn't going too well, because, see, back then, if you had done a fourth and fifth step, you became the elite in the program. because there wasn't too many people. And I used to say to my sponsor over and over, almost on a daily basis, don't you think you ought to put us on a fourth step? And he'd look at me and he'd say, you're too sick, work the first three. And this went on for a long period of time. Then finally, one day, he says, you can start your fourth step. 24 hours later, I called him up and said, I'm done. And he said, Vito, if I knew you wanted to go to confession, I would have gave you directions to the Catholic Church. But what a fourth step is a searching and fearless moral inventory. And I says, what does that mean? What does morals mean? I had no idea what this stuff meant. And I was supposed to have been a master of the English language. He said, part of it is a confession. Part of it is history. But what it is, a very searching and fearless moral inventory. And I said, well, how do I do it? He said, what I want you to do is write about your life, your past, and write how you felt about your past as it was being created, to the best of your memory. And then when you finish that, I want you to write about the same things, but I want you to write about how you feel about those things today. And he said, one will tell me where you were, the second writing will tell me where you've come to, so when we do a fifth step, I'll know where you need to go. And so I got busy and I started to write about my past and my feelings associated it to the best of my memory when I was being created. And then I wrote about how I felt about it today. And when I finished, I called my sponsor up and I made an appointment to do a fifth step with him. And I figured I had this man captured for 24 hours. And I was still living in San Diego then, and we made an appointment to meet in a place called Chula Vista, which is halfway between Tijuana, Mexico and San Diego. And it was like desert back then. And we sat on these rocks, and I had all my writings. And I picked them up to start reading, and immediately he said to me, you're not reading any of that. And I got a resentment. I figured I worked all this time on my masterpiece, and now you're not going to let me read it? And he said to me, the whole idea of writing the fourth step was for you. It was to introduce Vito to you. It's like priming a well. He said, what it did, he said, you remember when you used to call me up when you were writing your fourth step and you used to say, well, I can't finish this, it's too painful, I'm going to use. And I used to tell you, call somebody up in the program and talk about it. Because that's what a fourth step's supposed to be. It's supposed to be painful. It's supposed to bring up those feelings. What you were doing was priming the well and bringing everything up to the top. Now that you got it on paper, you could glance at it and start talking, but a lot more is going to come out of you than it's on that paper. And that's what had happened. We sat there and we talked about what I wrote, and a lot more came out. And when we finished, I looked for this great big spiritual awakening, because I heard addicts come into meetings after a fifth step and said, it's like the city sanitation department came and took everything away. And I didn't feel anything except I was glad that I did my fifth step, and I go to a meeting and said I did a fifth step. And that's the only feelings that I had. And my sponsor just laughed and he said, if most people are honest, that's all they'll feel after they do a fifth step. The value of the fifth step comes in the weeks and the months after you do it, because the garbage is gone and your program and your willingness to work a program becomes more available. And that's where the spiritual awakening came. And isn't it funny how the sixth step follows the fifth step? We became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. So this agnostic says to the sponsor, is this where you get on your knees and pray and God takes them away? And he informed me that there is nothing in the sixth step that God takes away our defects. It says Vito becomes entirely ready to let the process begin. And that's all the sixth step is. It's a step of willingness, of becoming ready. And he explained to me the difference between a defect and a shortcoming. He said, even though they're rooted in the same word, there's a difference. A defect is part of me, part of my personality, like my disease, like a defective car. I have imperfect parts about me, and they're called defects. And the shortcoming is when I act out on those defects. And there's a big difference. And my late wife, when she shared, she used to say it this way, the sixth step is packing the suitcase, and the seventh step is taking the trip. And that's the difference between them. Even though they're the same, there is but a difference. And he told me that I would become entirely ready if I took a piece of paper and drew a line right down the center of the piece of paper. On the left of that line, I listed all the defects and patterns that was identified in the fifth step. On the opposite side of the line, just opposite each one of them, I would put their opposites. One would tell me where I'm at, the other would tell me where I needed to go, and that became my roadmap for recovery. And he said, when if I was willing to do that, I would become entirely ready. And so when I finished that and I brought it to him and we sat down and we talked about it, and he says, it's time for the seventh step. And I said, is this where you get on your knees and pray? And he said, no. He said, you can if you want. There's nothing wrong with prayer. But the seventh step says we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And for an addict, any addict to become humble is when that addict owns his own shit. Especially male addicts. You know, male addicts are never wrong. They're always right. And I'm sure it's just as true here in Denmark as it is in the United States. And when people start owning their own stuff, that's a humbling situation. And if we're willing to do that, then God will remove our shortcomings through the first three steps. And at that time, I had a very big shortcoming. I had something called violent jealousy. And there's a lot of men in this room know that what I'm talking about. It's the kind of jealousy where you become physical even before you're verbal. And who the hell would want to stay in a relationship to get their head kicked in? And I couldn't stay in a relationship, and I wondered why. And I was told what I had to do was take my shortcomings and go down to the first step and surrender that I was powerless over that feeling of jealousy. Not deny it, get in touch with it, feel the unmanageability coming in my life, feeling myself becoming unglued, getting in touch with all that unmanageability, and then going to a second step and see the insanity if I acted out on my feelings, and then go to a third step and take those feelings and turn them over to the care of my God, asking for guidance, and go back to a second step and do it different. And I was told that was the formula to work on every shortcoming. And I'd like to say I did it one time and it went away, and it didn't. But by continually working the process of the first three steps, I can say it's at least 32, 33 years since I've had that problem. And see, then I was told to take each one of my stuff off that six-step lift as they were prioritized and work each one of them down the line with the first three steps. But what my sponsor did not tell me is when that list got all clean and those shortcomings were all gone, I'd find out I had a whole bunch of new ones that I didn't know I had. It's like peeling the onion. And I was also told, well, today I can observe, I can tell when people are starting to get better, and it usually starts after the seventh step. With men, you could tell they're getting better because they wind up being wrong and admit it. And with women, you know they're getting better because they stop saying they're sorry for when he's wrong. Because that's very common with addicts. They're never wrong with the males, and the women are always taking the blame for what her man does. And so when you start standing on your own two feet after the seventh step, that's when that process begins. And then in the eighth step, you know, we made a list and then became willing to make amends to all those we had harmed. I told my sponsor when I became willing, I would make the list. And he said, read the step. And I read the step. It said, we made a list, then became willing. So again, we know that an addict wrote these steps. And so like most addicts, I went and I made the list. And I came to my sponsor and said, here's a damn list, but I'm still not willing. He said, yes, you are. You wouldn't have made the list. That's when we know the steps start working us. And being a typical addict, you know how we go from one extreme? I figured everybody in the world owed me Christmas presents. I didn't owe anybody anything. Then I finally make the list and surrender to it. I want to go out and make amends to everybody in the whole world. And he says, no, that is why number nine is number nine. You sit down with a predecessor and you discuss them. Because if left to your own device, you will harm more people than do good. And we went over through that list. And there were certain ones, he says, you make that amends. No, you're not going to make that amends, because if you do it, you're going to cause them more harm. He said, but you're not going to get away scot-free. You must make those amends through your higher power. You give it to, and if your higher power feels that it needs to be done, the circumstances will arise. And then there was all those hidden people, you know, those like two ships passing in the night. A lot of them you don't even remember. Well, those amends have to be made, and they have to be made through your higher power. And if your higher power feels you need to make a direct amends, he will put those people back in your life. And I've had people come back into my life as much as 20 years later. And I knew it was time, and I knew it was why they were there. And I knew why they weren't there before, because I would not have been able to make the amends. And I believe there are no coincidences in this program. Everything happens for a reason, and it happens in God's time. Also, there's a very important part of the ninth step that is not talked about. He said we made direct amends to all those we had harmed, except when to do so would injure them or others? Well, who is or others? We are part of others, and we did not come this far in recovery to injure ourselves. And that's why we need somebody who came before us to sit down and say, no, you don't make that amend, because you not only injure somebody else, you will injure yourself. And that needs to be turned over to God too. And I was told the first three steps is what keep me physically clean. And steps 4 through 9 is what get me spiritually and emotionally clean. And steps 10 through 12 are the maintenance and growth steps. And on the 10th step, it said we continue to take personal inventory when we are wrong, promptly admit it. And I used to think when it said we're wrong, that means to go around apologizing and saying I'm sorry. And my sponsor said I suffered from another disease called sorry-itis. And most addicts know how to use that word, I'm sorry, to the hilt. We know how to use it, you know, it's to the point that our family says, yeah, you're sorry, you're a sorry human being. But what it says, when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. What it is saying to us is self-honesty, to admit to ourselves that we're wrong. Because until we admit that we're wrong to ourselves, we can't do anything about it. And when we take a personal inventory and we look at our day, and when we were wrong and admit it to ourselves, we can make it a point that tomorrow we're not going to make the same mistake again. We're going to incorporate it into our program so we don't keep making the same mistake. And that's what being wrong and promptly admits it all about. And it's very important to do a written 10th step. I had done a written 10th step for almost the first 15 years I was in this program. I don't do it today. I do a mental 10th step because I'm so used and ingrained. I go through my day when I'm wrong, I admit it, and I try to make my plans for tomorrow that doesn't happen again. But if we do a thorough 10th step on a daily basis and we're very thorough with it, we never have to go back and do a 4th and 5th step again. Because if anybody's going back and doing 4th and 5th steps over and over again, they are not doing a 10th step on a daily basis. And that's why the 10th step is there for maintenance and growth. In the 11th step, it talks about through prayer and meditation improve our conscious contact with God of our understanding, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And I think the 11th step is the most important step of all the steps. Because within the 11th step is our key to recovery. It talks about prayer and meditation that we've been doing it. And thank God this program does not tell us how to pray, and it doesn't tell us how to meditate, but it tells us that we must do it. And I've heard people, and I think even in some of our literature, it says that prayer is asking and meditation is listening. And that may be true, but my personal experience is only my personal experience. I believe that meditation is the highest form of prayer that there is, because in that instant, that moment of conscious contact, which can be achieved through meditation, you no longer need to ask, because the communication is there, and instantly between you and your higher power, everything that needs to be said is said in a split second. So I believe meditation is the highest form of prayer. And I've read a writer once said that if you don't go within, you go without. And I really believe that. And then it talks about praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. I have learned through a lot of hard knocks and a lot of pains what God's will is. And I believe God's will is the highest good for all concerned. And so if I get myself out of the way in any of my prayers, I ask God for the highest good and all concerned in any situation, the answer will be the right answer. I may not like the answer, and that answer may cause me pain, but in hindsight, that answer is always the right answer and the highest good for all concerned. And asking for the power to carry that out. And the power to carry that out is very simple, for me to get the hell out of the way. Because my highest good is what I want for me, and that is disastrous. So I find that if I pray only for the God, for the highest will of all concerned in any situation and get out of the way, then that's the power to carry that out. Because as long as I don't put my 2 cents in, it works out the way it's supposed to. And there are no coincidences in this program, and there are no coincidences in life, and I really believe that. And then in the 12th step, it says, as a result of these steps, we had a spiritual awakening. I believe that spiritual awakening is that these steps work. And I've had people say, well, how can the steps work for everything? Well, I believe they're the solution to all life's problems. And people will say to me, well, it can't fix a relationship, It can't fix a financial problem. It can't fix a job problem. But my answer is always the same. What it does, it fixes or changes my reaction to the problem so I don't have to pick up and use, and that's why the steps are always the answer. And then it further says, as a result of these steps, we had a spiritual awakening, and we tried to carry this message to other addicts. What message? The message of the previous 11 steps. It's right there in black and white. We tried to carry this message to other addicts and practice these principles in all of our affairs. And thank God they said the word practice, because if I had to do them perfect, I would be in a lot of trouble. But I believe the steps are the answer. You know, years ago, we used to have a lot of people we'd call two-steppers. They come in, do a first step, and start doing 12-step work. And we wondered why they didn't stay clean. We need all 12 steps. The 12 steps are for my personal recovery. It's a program of recovery. Meetings is not a program. Meetings is fellowship. This convention is fellowship. The program of Narcotics Anonymous is 12 steps and 12 traditions. That is the program. That's the spiritual principles. And I worked this program for quite some time. And I think I had about 15 or 16 years clean. And I had a crisis come in my life. And I couldn't handle it, and I knew I was going to go out and use. And so what I did is I locked myself in a room, because I stopped going to meetings for a year. I was going to do it on willpower, because I graduated from the 12-step academy. Ear plurimus cured. And so my contacts and my ego, I couldn't go back to you folks and say that you were right, because you folks told me if I stopped going to meetings, I would relapse. So I figured if I locked myself in the room and I made it till morning when the sun came up, I would be okay. And I remember that night banging my head on the wall, putting my fist through the wall, and that Pied Piper was out my window still calling me. And morning came, and it was still there. And I knew if I left the house, I would go out and use, and I would probably die. So I tied a rope around my neck and jumped off a chair. The weight of my body broke the door down, and the girl that I was married at that time cut me down. The ambulance came. The paramedics, they used shock treatments. They said I was clinically dead, and they brought me back to life. And they brought me to a hospital, to a psychiatric ward, because where I lived in the States, if you tried to commit suicide, they could lock you up in a psych ward for 25 to 30 days. So I had to have an interview with a psychiatrist. And thank God this woman had some knowledge of the disease of addiction, because after we talked for about an hour, she says, Vito, you're a little nuts like most people, but your biggest problem is you're an addict without a program. If I don't commit you, do you promise to get your ass to a meeting? And I ran to a meeting. And the words of my first sponsor was echoing in my ears, when you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you begin to rot. And what had happened is I started to rot. You see, because I was what is known as an N.A. thief, I came in here and I took, and I gave nothing back. I wouldn't sponsor anybody because that was an inconvenience. It interfered with my life. I came to Narcotics Anonymous because I wanted to stay clean. And I knew now that recovery is not a spectator process. It's a participation process. And I had to get involved in service. I had to get involved in sponsorship. I had to give it away to keep it, or I'd get ripe again. And I got very heavily back involved in the program. And obviously that marriage didn't work. And I came back into the rooms and met another addict, and we got married, and we were together for 18 years till she died. But the reason that marriage was successful is because we have another set of principles called the 12 traditions. And the 12 traditions are written on us how to have relationships with other people. Now, they're written for the group, but the group is the first portion of relationships that we have in recovery. And each one of those traditions have a spiritual thing behind them. And I'm going to go through them. I haven't done this in a number of years, but they asked me to go through them. So I'm going to go through each one of these traditions and identify the spiritual principles behind them of how this are so dynamic within our relationships. In the first tradition, it says our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. What is unity? Unity is not uniformity. It's oneness. It's binding together. And it talks in here our common welfare. Well, our common welfare in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous is that we suffer from a common disease, and our common welfare is that we are to recover together from the disease of addiction. And that's what we have in common. And if we bind behind that common thing that we have, that unity, which is a spiritual principle, then we'll all recover together. But that principle works in our home groups when we're having relationships with our other members, that if we remember what we're there for in our common welfare, when we come together for group conscience and we focus on our common welfare, then that unity will always manifest itself. But take that same spiritual principle and bring it into your family unit, and you identify the common welfare of that family, and all of a sudden that family becomes unified rather than separate. And that's a very dynamic principle when you come into work and you're working a job. What is the common welfare of every person on that job? If you identify it, then you have unity, and all of a sudden your job and your professional life becomes better. And then in our second tradition, it talks about, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants that do not govern. For the group, we have one ultimate authority, and that ultimate authority is a loving and caring God that comes together when all of our minds come together and try to bring some kind of consciousness together. And then it further goes on to say that is the ultimate authority. And then it talks about our leaders are but trusted servants. And what does that mean? It means that our leaders do not govern. And the word govern strictly means to make decisions for us. And when they say our leaders are but trusted servants, they're trusted to carry that ultimate authority, that loving group conscience, to represent us and not govern for us. And therefore, it binds the anonymity of the first tradition. And if we take that spiritual tradition of that group conscience into our family units, what happens? We have no leaders in the family. We may have a husband and we may have a wife and we may have children, but each of them have their anonymity. And they may have certain designations of what they do within the family unit, but there's no boss. There's just a loving authority as God that expresses in the consciousness of that family. And therefore, the leader of that family or designated leader of that family does not govern that family. He carries out the wishes of the family unit, the group conscience of that family. And all of a sudden, when addicts start practicing the second tradition within their family unit, loving relationships begin to blossom and busted relationships begin to come back together because it's a spiritual principle on how to have a good relationship. And our third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. And in this fellowship, that means everybody is welcome. Even the person using, as long as that person using has a desire to stop. And, you know, sometimes we make fun of relapsers, but I'll tell you, can you imagine how hard it is for a relapser to come back into these rooms and face us? I give credit to people that have the courage to come back. And the fact that they show up again means that they have a desire to stop using, or what else would they be doing in these rooms? You know, and sometimes we drive people out by saying, what are you doing here? You're making a joke of recovery. You can't stay clean. If they drag their ass back in, they have a desire, and we have an obligation to carry that message. But take the spiritual principle behind that third tradition and bring it into your family unit. Every member of our family has a right to be a member of that family if they have a desire to be there. And sometimes we have disowned our children or our parents have disowned us. But if we practice that spiritual tradition of the third tradition, our mended family units start coming back together. Because the only thing that required to be in our family is a desire to be there. And our fourth tradition, which talks about each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or NA as a whole. Well, that's written for the group, and that simply means that any NA group could do anything it wants to do, except if what it does affects the other groups in the area or NA as a whole. And that's why groups have the right to have their own meeting formats. Every meeting format at a group does not have to be the same. They could have different topics. They can have different styles within their recovery, as long as that doesn't affect the other groups in the area or Narcotics Anonymous as a whole. Because, you see, the group is supposed to express the personality of its home group members. And that's what gives diversity within our fellowship. But yet, if we do that in our family units, that we say that every member of our family is autonomous, except when to do so would affect other members of the family or society at large, we have a very valuable principle to have within our loving relationships. If a husband allows his wife to be totally autonomous and do whatever she wants, as long as it doesn't affect the family unit or society at whole, relationships strengthen. You see, it's not about control. It's a lot about letting people grow and have the autonomy to be their own self, their own free human being, as long as it doesn't affect the family unit or society at whole. And then our relationships begin to get better. And see, if we're working just steps in our life and not traditions, we only got half a program and we wonder why we're miserable. And we didn't come in recovery to stay miserable. In the fifth tradition, it talks about, what's the exact wording? Let me see. Each group has one primary purpose, to carry the message to the addict that still suffers. And that's the primary purpose of a group, to carry the message that any addict can stop using. Any addict. And that's our primary purpose. We're not here to carry about that you can get a good job, you could find a relationship, you can get marriage counseling. The message that we carry, our primary purpose, is you don't ever have to use again. You don't have to feel the horrors of addiction. That's our message. That's our primary purpose. And if we carry that same fifth tradition into our families and we identify what's the primary purpose of a family unit, the purpose is that the family becomes functional, loving, and caring. And that's the only purpose of the family. And we've learned that by being a member of a home group and being participating in home group and learning these traditions and carrying them. And the sixth tradition is nothing more than an extension of the fifth. It talks about what happens if we don't carry that primary purpose, if we don't follow a fifth tradition. It says an NA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the NA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. For the groups, it simply means is we don't have affiliation with clubhouses, with rehabs, with detox centers. We simply are with them through cooperation, not affiliation. Because once we affiliate with something, then money, power, and prestige gets in there. And us addicts are terrible with money, power, and prestige. We corrupt very easy. The disease of addiction is a disease of corruption. And we have seen many addicts with many fine programs through money, power, or prestige become corrupted in their whole program. And then after, when all said is done, there's a lot of relapses over it. So the sixth tradition tells us how not to divert from that primary purpose. But if we carry that principle of not diverting into our family units, and we know what our family unit is there for, and we don't divert from the primary purpose, if there's no cheating going on or other things or taking food money and gambling it away, that the primary purpose of the family, that is to function and not divert from it, then families get stronger and better, and addicts get stronger and better, and we recover better. And relationships get better, and families don't break up, and there's not divorce. And the seventh tradition tells us we ought to be self-supporting through our own contributions, and we know the reason for that. If we have a meeting in the church, and the pastor of that church says, well, you folks are doing a good job, you can have this meeting space for free, and we accept that, that means 2 months later, when he wants to come down and preach to us before the meeting, we have to sit there because, you see, we're beholden to him. But if we pay him rent, we're a tenant. And we're there for Narcotics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous only. And that means that we support ourselves. And supporting isn't always reaching into your pocket and taking money out, because many addicts walk in here and don't have a penny to put in the basket. But what we can do is clean ashtrays, sweep floors, put tables up, make coffee. That's all part of being self-supporting. And you see, when you learn to do that within Narcotics Anonymous, you learn to be self-supporting and pay your bills. And when you learn to do that and pay your bills and be self-supporting, your family becomes stronger, your relationships become stronger. But you learn that by being in a home group. And then we go on to the eighth tradition, and it talks about Narcotics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers, which simply means no matter who you are outside of these rooms, whether you're a doctor, lawyer, or candlestick maker, when you walk into the rooms, you're just an addict. Your professionalism is left outside the rooms. And we have many people in these rooms that work in rehabs, our addiction counselors, our professional people of all types. But you see, when you come in the rooms, We all become equal, and therefore we're all the same. And, you know, we don't have any professionals in Narcotics Anonymous, but we can hire professionals to do the work that we can't do ourselves. And that's where it says, for instance, if we have a service office, we can hire somebody, whether they be an addict or a non-addict, to be an employee there. But when they're an employee there, they're not part of Narcotics Anonymous. They're employed by Narcotics Anonymous. And that's where the distinction ends. And when we talk about NA, we're talking about in the rooms, we're all the same. And in our ninth tradition, it says NA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. What is NA as such? Well, the second edition of the basic text explained it very beautifully. NA as such is the recovery meeting. And that's all NA is the recovery meeting where we meet to share our experience, strength, and hope. And then when he talked about the ninth tradition in the basic text in the first and second edition, it says all else is not NA. And unfortunately, that was taken out when they made the thing to the third edition, but that stays the same today. NA as such is the recovery meeting, and that ought never be organized. But that recovery meeting may create service boards or committees to do the other things. And those committees are responsible to those they serve. And who they serve? They serve the home group who serves its individual members. And that is NA as such. So we don't stop an NA meeting in the middle of it and say we're going to have business now. That is conducted before or after the meeting. But that those service committees are responsible directly to the individual addict. You see, the World Service Office is responsible to the regions. The regions are responsible to the areas. The areas are responsible to the groups. And the groups are responsible to its individual members. It's an inverted pyramid. But yet we have people in this fellowship that think that we are responsible to the world. We are not. The world is responsible to the individual addicts. Because through group conscious, we could change anything in Narcotics Anonymous. Starting from one member coming into a group, making a motion, sending it to area, to region, to world. And that's how things are changed. But we also can all take that principle in our family, that the family as such is not organized. The family is that little loving, caring unit. But that family can organize committees that are directly responsible. They can organize a member to pay the bills, another member to do cleaning, another member to watch the children. But they're all responsible directly to the family unit, not to an individual. It's a spiritual principle that gives us that autonomy within the family. And then in the 10th tradition, it talks about Narcotics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the NA name ought never be drawn into controversy. We have no opinion what the government does about drug addiction. We have no opinion what the politics of a country is. We have no opinion on anything outside the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. As a member of Narcotics Anonymous, I have no opinion on anything in this whole world except on my personal recovery within the rooms and then what goes on in Narcotics Anonymous. If we do so, we drag the NA way into controversy. If I go around talking about who I believe the politicians should be and what should be done in a world on drug and drug addiction, they're not saying that Vito said it. They're saying Narcotics Anonymous said it because I'm speaking as a member of NA. So I cannot have an opinion on anything outside of these rooms. And if we take that spiritual principle into our family units, if we have only opinions what's going on in our family and we have no opinion what's going on to the people next door or on the other side of us, all of a sudden we get along with our neighbors. And we've learned that by coming into these rooms and not having opinion on outside issues. We have opinions within our own families, but what my next-door neighbor does within their families is an outside issue. And if I stay out of it, I can remain friends and have relationships with those people. And again, it's a spiritual principle. And this 11th tradition talks about our public relation policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We always need personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films, which is for a reason. Anonymity, if I was to speak on television on behalf of Narcotics Anonymous to public, I would be Narcotics Anonymous. And I don't have a right to speak for this fellowship, and none of us do. So we keep personal anonymity at that level of radio, press, and film. I could break my anonymity with anybody I want as a person, but I can't do it on behalf of the fellowship. And the same thing, if I learn that within my family that I maintain anonymity and protect their will and not go around saying what's going on in my family to people that have no business, all of a sudden my relationships get stronger. And then the 12th tradition sums up all the traditions like the 12th step does. It says anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, which simply means that anonymity runs through all of our traditions, and it's the foundation of them all. And then it goes on further to say, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And what that simply means is we take the personality out of the way. When somebody comes into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, I don't care if they're ugly, beautiful, good-looking, rich, poor, professional, gutter, it doesn't matter. If we get the personality out of the way and we allow them to be nothing more than an addict, then they can recover and we can recover at the same time. How many times have we seen a new girl come into the rooms, sick as can be, trying to get clean, and all the guys just can't wait to take advantage of her? What has happened is they have not given the 12th tradition, because, see, they identify her as somebody that they can get with rather than let her recover. But if we let everybody come into the rooms, they're not male, female, black, white, red, yellow. They're nothing more than an addict, and they can recover, and so can we. But the minute we put a personality to it, good-looking, bad-looking, rich, poor, they can't recover, and neither we can. Anonymity in the 12th edition doesn't just mean what you hear at meetings, leave there. It means allow a person to be nothing more than an addict. Get the personality away. And when I identify myself at meetings, I say I'm an addict called Vito, and I always put the addict before my name to remind me to place the principle of addiction before my personality. And see, if we take that same principle and allow it into our personal relationships and get the personality out and let the person be themselves, another human being, we get along well with people. And that's why these spiritual principles, all 24 of them, are important. The 12 steps for my personal recovery and the 12 traditions so I can have relationships with other people. And I'm going to end this right now very simply telling you where I am in my life. A little over 4 years ago, my wife, who would have had about 18 years clean now, died from the disease of cancer. She was a smoker. And at that time when it happened, I came home from a meeting, and I found her almost dead on the floor. And I took her to a hospital, and they told me she was brain dead. And they had her alive on life support, and I needed to disconnect her. And I refused to do that because I felt I was killing my wife. And I finally surrendered and took her off life support, and she passed away in less than a minute. And when that happened, I wanted to use. I did not want recovery anymore. And I knew I was going to go out and use. And people come to my house, and I wouldn't let them in, and I wouldn't answer the phone. And the next morning, I went to make arrangements for her funeral, and when I came home, the addicts had broken into my house and had food on the table and coffee going. And I said, fine, you can stay here to the funeral. I won't use, but when the funeral's over, I'm going to use. And the funeral was over, and everybody left, and I had one sponsee that spent a week with me, and he refused to leave. So I said very simply, when you leave, I'm going to get high. He said, fine. And nothing was said the rest of that week. We didn't go to a meeting. He just babysat me. And it was Thursday night. He was catching a plane out the next day. And he said, you're going to use tomorrow, aren't you? I said, you better believe it. I said, this thing about being happy, joyous, and free is bullshit. I worked the program, and look what God did to me. And I was very angry at God. And he said, fine. He says, you got my blessing. You can go out and use. I just want you to do one thing for me, the same thing that you ask everybody else who comes to you and tells you that you're going to use. And for years, I would tell everybody that I sponsored the same thing. You want to use? You got my blessing? Go around and tell everybody Vito said it's okay. Just do one thing first. Do a 90 and 90. And at the end of the 90 and 90, if you want to use, feel free to do it. And he looked at me and he said, you have told people that through the years. Would you not take your own advice? Now, ego is a very, very powerful thing. So I looked at him and I says, all right, I'll do a 90 and 90. But when I'm done with that 90 and 90, I'm going to use. Well, I wound up doing about 190 meetings in 45 days. And at that point, I woke up one day and my grief had turned to gratitude. I heard like a voice go off in my head and said, "You stupid asshole. You had a wonderful marriage for 18 years. Some people don't have one good relationship in their life, and you have the nerve to be unhappy about it." I was able to take my wedding band off, put it on my keychain to remind me that I had a good relationship and go on with my life. And that grief turned to gratitude, and I didn't relapse. But, you know, the saying, more will be revealed. After 18 years, being single again has been quite a trip for the last 5 years. And I don't want to go into all that garbage because it'd be a new soap opera called The Perils of Vito. But I am in a relationship today. Where it's going, I don't know. We live 800 miles apart. But, you know, I can't do anything simple. But, you know, so far everything is going good. And all I can say is what the basic text says, more will be revealed. So I'd like to thank you all for letting me come here and share. It's been an honor and a pleasure, and I love you all. When they stop, stop them first. I'd like to say one more thing. The fellowship here in Denmark is great. There's one thing, though, that irks me, and I got to say it because I can't keep my mouth shut. I get myself in trouble. Everywhere in the world where NA ends their meetings and they close in a circle of hugs. And I've noticed here you folks still close a circle of holding hands like the other fellowship does. And in Narcotics Anonymous, when we close our meeting, our circle is a circle of hugs. We don't hold hands in Narcotics Anonymous. And maybe it's time to join the rest of us in the world and close. Other than that, you got a beautiful fellowship here. Sorry, I had to say that.
Thank you, Vito.